From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Bubble Park City College.
South San Francisco.
Downtown.
ATL.
Pittsburgh.
P-World.
Oakland. Corona Heights, San Francisco.
Coming up, the dilemma of a parent whose child has a disability.
I knew that there was something wrong and I wanted him to be able to receive services, but at the same time, it's not a pleasant experience to go and watch your child, you know, fail at all of these assessments and tests.
We'll meet a family who's been navigating the system for 5 years. Then from the San Quentin Prison Report, we'll hear about a program that trains inmates to care for their elderly and disabled brethren.
I can't begin to explain what it feels like to sit there with somebody and you can see the frustration on their face that they're forgetting stuff, that, you know what I mean, they're able to acknowledge that their mind is slipping.
What it takes to care for others, that's coming up today on Cross Currents. The birth of a child is life-changing for any parent. But for many California families, there's an extra challenge to think about. According to the National Survey of Children's Health, 1 out of every 10 of our state's children has a special health care need, including autism, cerebral palsy, or mental retardation.
I would love to say that disabilities are a natural part of life.
Juno Duenas works with Support for Families of Children with Disabilities. That's a nonprofit based in San Francisco.
It's not the disability itself that's a problem. It's how we provide services and what kind of supports that we have in the community to help people with disabilities be a part of the community.
Today, we're going to explore how local government steps in to help these children and their families. As part of our series, Auditing Bureaucracy, KALW's Mary Willis found a complex system plagued by budget cuts and dealing with a growing number of kids in need. Her story starts with a family in Alameda.
Nice. Oh, you got your shoes.
6-year-old Lucian Gonzalez is sitting on the couch in his living room and tapping a small drum. He glances up at me, then shyly buries his head in his mother, Susie Clements's, arms. She tells me he hasn't shown this kind of self-consciousness before.
Well, it's a good thing for him developmentally, just that he's kind of aware enough of you and being a new person, and that he would have that kind of response to you, as opposed to either just completely disregarding you or kind of being inappropriately familiar. He's always liked tapping on things, and he'll always held things to his ear and tap them to see what kind of different sounds they make. But you can see that he also likes the sensation of it on his hands.
Back when Lucian was 9 months old, his parents began to notice he was missing some milestones. He took a long time to sit up, took a long time to crawl. At 11 months, they started to make some calls. They made an appointment with a neurologist, and they contacted the East Bay Regional Center to get their son assessed.
I knew that there was something wrong, and I wanted him to be able to receive services, but at the same time, it's not a pleasant experience to go and watch your child, you know, fail at all of these assessments and tests. So you're kind of put in this weird position of kind of wanting them to fail so that they will qualify for the services, but also kind of having your heart broken as you watch them fail.
The East Bay Regional Center, where Lucian was assessed, is a private nonprofit. It's contracted with the California Department of Developmental Services. It serves 16,000 adults and kids with disabilities. The center determines whether a person is eligible for services, and if so, then helps find resources and connects them. 5 years ago, Lucian was diagnosed as developmentally delayed. Later, the diagnosis was autism. Now, his care has become an intrinsic part of his family's life. During the week, Lucian goes to a special day class in Alameda, which is offered through the school district. After school, he has 2 hours of therapy. Most therapists working with children with autism are paid through various sources, including state funding, insurance, private pay, and public schools.
So what would be like the best one? Probably this one?
The Apples, probably.
Or maybe we can even just do it for him having a BM.
We did start, he also can have, we introduced baked pineapple.
Lucian's therapist, Bridget Barsotti, chats with Susie Clement before starting her son's therapy.
Say B. Say B.
Barsotti sits cross-legged on the ground with Lucian, running through exercises and marking his progress.
Hi there!
There you go.
A clinical director with her company, SDE Consultants, is also here today. His name is David Cox, and he explains to me what's going on.
It's that ability to make a request for a given object, which he's had some difficulty with in the past, so...
Letter toy. Good asking.
Because of our ability to advocate, I think that we are able to get pretty good services for our son. But in general, I think there are a lot of people out there that aren't. And a lot of it does have to do with how complicated it is.
The systems are complicated. No, I do not think they have to stay like that.
Juno Duenas is director of the San Francisco-based group Support for Families of Children with Disabilities. Part of its role is to help families wade through what services are available.
Each system is its own silo, with the family running up, if you can visualize this, running up to the top of the silo to find out if their child is eligible for those services, and maybe told no and then has to run down and go to the next system.
There are four main systems that families deal with when getting help for their kids with disabilities: regional centres, school districts, medical insurance companies, and California Children's Services.
Services are great. The challenge for families is they need to understand all these different systems.
It's not only the complexity that Susie Clement is concerned about, it's also the long wait times. She says it took about 3.5 months from her initial phone call to the regional centre to get the services for Lucian.
So it just takes a really long time, and when you're sitting there with your with your infant or your toddler, knowing that something is going on and you're just not able to make things move any more quickly to get them what they need, it's very frustrating.
We're not necessarily a crisis response, call us and immediately get eligible. That's not how the system was set up.
Pam Thomas is the Director of Client Services at the Regional Center of East Bay.
We can move it as fast as our system is able to at any given time, depending on what else is going on.
Thomas says regional centres have to abide by legislated timeframes. To determine whether a family is eligible for services, the process has to take less than 120 days for kids over the age of 3 and 45 days for babies and toddlers. She explains that when a child is made eligible, they are assigned a group of workers called an interdisciplinary team, which also includes the family.
It's the responsibility or the task of that ID team to look at the specific individual situation and what kind of services are already there, what kind of generic services are available.
For example, if a child with cerebral palsy wanted to go swimming, a case manager would find places in the community that offers swimming lessons for kids with special needs.
It is based on individual need, so there isn't a one-size-fits-all or a everyone-gets-this.
But Thomas says California's regional centres have been strained by a series of budget cuts over the past 4 years due to the state's financial struggles.
There have been numerous furloughs, there have been layoffs, regional centres closing their doors a day or two a month simply from lack of funding. This regional center, what we chose to do was to not have furloughs or close our doors, but to not fill open positions, which meant caseloads went higher.
Thomas says things are looking up now for the regional center system, and state funding is rising again. The East Bay Center has hired about 45 case managers since January and are in the process of rebuilding the staff and system in general. That's important because the numbers of people who need services are also growing. The East Bay Regional Centre is working with 800 more children and adults than 2 years ago and 10,000 more than 20 years ago.
I think the regional centre systems were set up initially to fill a need, and I think that the system has become so large and the needs so varied that it's a challenge. It's just a challenge.
Back in Alameda, Susie Clement smiles as her son plays, but she frowns when she thinks of the path she and her family have taken to get here.
It's really daunting. It's really daunting, and you have to be so organized and so on it and all the time paying attention to it.
And as Lucian has gotten older, she says, the system has become more complicated. In California, when a child with a developmental disability, including autism, turns 3, school districts assume primary responsibility for providing services and educational support until the child finishes school. Then there are insurance companies charged with covering certain treatments for kids with autism.
So now we have 3 bureaucracies that we're dealing with, and they tend to want to punt the ball back and forth to each other.
All the time she spends working the system, that's less time spent with Lucian and less time with her photography business, which helps pay for it.
I appreciate Lucian so much. He brings so much to our family. But the practicalities of having a child with autism are very complicated. So we spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, is he getting the right therapies? Is there something else we should be trying? I wouldn't change him, but I wish that there was more support for kids with autism and just, you know, kids with disabilities in general.
In Alameda, I'm Mary Willis for Cross Currents.
If you're a parent of a disabled child, we'd love to hear about your experience. You can call and leave us a message at 415-264-7106. That number again is 415-264-7106.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. Families that rely on government help for their disabled child may depend on that care well into the child's adult life. Adults with disabilities often need the assistance of skilled caregivers, especially as they enter old age. That's no less true for disabled or elderly adults in prison. We're going to hear now about an innovative program to provide that care in our latest story from the San Quentin Prison Report. That's KALW's collaboration with inmates from California's oldest prison.
SQPR is a media collective of prisoners and volunteers from the community working together to give voice to personal growth, social transformation, and restorative justice.
At San Quentin, they're called Gold Coats, men who are trained to care for elderly or disabled prisoners. Although they are also inmates, these caregivers don't wear the standard prison blues. They've been working in California prisons for about 4 years now in an effort to comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. From SQPR, Tommy Shakur Ross introduces us to one Gold Coat worker.
Sandy Rashid Lockhart is 35 years old. In 2002, he robbed 4 men at gunpoint outside of a Walmart store in Lancaster, California. He was arrested, convicted, and sentenced to 24 years in state prison. That time hasn't been easy. He has gotten in trouble for refusing a cellmate, contraband, cell fighting, refusing a direct order, and being involved in a prison riot. Despite that, in 2009, he was entrusted with an extraordinary responsibility.
I've been assisting people with disabilities for about a little over maybe 3 or 4 years. I was doing it at CMC, California Men's Colony, San Luis Obispo. And what it was down there we worked with guys that had either severe head trauma or mental health issues, and guys that had stuff like severe dementia, Alzheimer's, etc. You know, do some studying on what exactly dementia and Alzheimer's was, what type of symptoms to look for and stuff like that.
But most of his training was on the job.
So, like, for instance, with the guys with dementia and Alzheimer's, basically from the time they get up to the time they go to sleep, we're available to them in their everyday functions. And then basically tucking them back in at the end of the night.
When Rashid arrived at San Quentin in 2012 and appeared before the Unit Classification Committee, they offered him a job similar to the one he had at CMC. San Quentin's program is called the Inmate Disability Assistant Program, IDAP. IDAP workers wear distinguishing gold smocks that contrast with the standard blue shirts and jeans that other prisoners wear. Hence, they are also referred to as gold coats. They are permitted to basically roam the prison and perform some of their duties. There are a total of 7 IDAP workers at San Quentin.
The gold coats, we have to be accessible to almost all areas of the prison where inmates are allowed to go, because you never know what we might be needed for. You know, as far as helping a guy in a wheelchair, he might have to go from one end of the institution to the next. So what they've done is they've put up signs everywhere with our pictures saying, you know, these are the IDAP workers, and so that way they know when we come through, oh, okay, he's with the program.
Rashid says the job is mostly mundane.
We're making sure that guys get to where they need to be at on time, take care of the everyday things that they need to take care of, like making sure that they, you know, clean their bed areas up and stuff like that.
Or like going to get their laundry or helping with canteen purchases.
You know, obviously if they're in a wheelchair, they can't carry the canteen. So what we do is we go with them and assist them and help, you know, carry that type of stuff.
Rashid says his work here at San Quentin is different than his former job at CMC. The work there was much more intimate, like with one elderly dementia patient named Bob.
I remember one morning I walked into a cell and I smelled something. I was like, man, what the hell is that, right? And I was like, oh, man, I already know what time it is, because he had some issues with his bowels. And he gets up and I'm like, come on, buddy, we got to get up. It's time to go, right? And the main thing with him was keeping him from wanting to touch stuff, because he always wanted to touch, you know. That was how he identified with things. So I had to bring it to his attention without really letting him know what was going on, because if I did, then he'd want to touch it. And from there on, it's a high-risk situation, you know, keeping him from touching it, touching his face, you know. Okay. And when I say it, I'm talking about, you know, crap, fecal matter. I get him up, and right off the bat, he knows. He says, you smell that? I was like, yeah, I smelled it, buddy. Let me check you out. So I checked the front of his boxers, checked the back. And I had turned away for a second, man. As soon as I turned back, man, he had a handful of crap, right? And I was just like, damn. So I'm telling him, hey, buddy, you can't do that, right? And he looks at me and he goes, man, did I do that? I said, yeah, you did that, buddy. And he goes, I'm f***ed up, ain't I?
Wow.
And I say, no, buddy, you all right.
Yeah.
And he tells me, thank you. You know what I mean? And, for me, that, you know, that kind of solidifies what I do, you know, when he looks at me and says, thank you, you know what I mean? Anything else is irrelevant at that point.
I asked him what it feels like to do this type of work.
I can't begin to explain what it feels like to sit there with somebody and you can see the frustration on their face that they're forgetting stuff, that, you know what I mean? They're able to acknowledge that their mind is slipping.
The job pays a mere $56 a month. But Rashid is okay with that. He says his biggest payoff is that serving others has given his life new meaning.
I didn't really know what humility was until I was able to help a grown man change his boxers or get in and out of the shower, have to get in there with the rag and wash his nuts for him. So I didn't know what it was like to have to sit there and allow a man to chew me out and call me all kinds of names, yeah, right, just in the hopes that I can still be effective in his life. You know, I didn't know what humility was until I got put in those situations. So it's humbled me.
He also learned some things about himself that he had not known prior to working with ailing prisoners.
It's taught me that I love to be in service to people. You know what I mean? That I think I have a calling in that regard, right? I mean, I've never really cared about anybody else. I mean, I've always been selfish. So now I feel like, you know, being a servitude fulfills something within me. You know what I mean? And it gives me purpose. Like, I look forward to getting up, running over, and picking my guys up. You know what I mean? Getting them going, making sure that they're up and ready to go to chow.
Unfortunately, Rashid's job as an IDAP worker didn't last. He approached me during post-production of the story and informed me that he pled guilty to a serious rule violation. He was caught in possession of a cell phone. Consequently, he was fired. I asked him, why would he jeopardize a job that was so important to him? He told me that his grandfather was dying and he needed to mend relationships with his family. I'm Tommy Shakur Ross with the San Quentin Prison Report. I'm out.
The San Quentin Prison Report is a partnership with KALW to bring stories from inside of California's oldest prison to the public radio airwaves.
The San Quentin Prison Report is produced by founding director Troy Williams and managing director Nigel Poore. SQPR is made possible by the support of Warden Kevin Chappelle, Public Information Officer Lieutenant Sam Robinson, and Television Specialist Larry Schneider.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Pianist Jason Moran is resident artistic director at the SF Jazz Center this week. He's also curated a series of concerts with his bold blend of influences, which range from classical to hip-hop to stride piano. Moran is a MacArthur Genius Award winner, and he teaches at the New England Conservatory of Music. KALW contributor Reese Ehrlich spoke with Moran about balancing teaching and touring, and about his recent work celebrating the life of Fats Waller.
Jason Moran became famous in the 1990s as a young rebel, playing his own unique styles. He became known as one of the finest interpreters of Thelonious Monk's music, and he composes many original tunes. In addition to a busy touring schedule, Moran teaches at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston.
I learn a lot from what the other students are doing. You know, it keeps me kind of engaged or in touch with kind of like what's happening in contemporary music. From a 19-year-old's perspective, and that's helpful.
Yeah, we thought we were always going to be young, right?
That's a rough one watching, you know, these perpetual youngsters come in.
Jason Moran has been studying the music of the great stride piano masters such as James P. Johnson and Fats Waller. Moran received a commission to perform and update some of Waller's music. He incorporates into his performance some of Fats Waller's famous showmanship. For example, he had an artist create a Fats Waller mask.
That is like a Mardi Gras mask, Fats Waller's head. Commissioned it from a Haitian artist named Didier Civil. You know, he makes this mask, and so I wear it for half of the show. I literally am wearing Fats Waller's head and playing the rest of the show and dancing with his head on and inviting people up to dance and kind of engaging, you know, the crowd with this kind of oversized head. And, you know, it almost looks like it's a, you know, life-size bobblehead.
Old-time pianists could change time signatures or musical accents on a moment's notice.
In the stride, you hear this bon-dink, bon-dink, bon-dink kind of sound happening in the left hand. But they would double up on it sometimes. So it's bon-dink, bon-ba-donk, bon-bink, don-bon-dink, bon-ba-donk-dink. Like, that's a very syncopated approach to the left hand rather than this constant oompa thing.
Continues to impress audiences with his ability to play both old-time and contemporary jazz. I'm Reese Ehrlich with a perspective on jazz, reporting from the Montreal Jazz Festival.
Jason Moran is in residence at the SF Jazz Center this week, Wednesday through Monday. For more information or to hear more jazz perspectives, go to our website, kalw.org, and click on Cross Currents. And that's all the time we have for today's Cross Currents from KLW News. Our team includes Jen Chien, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Seth Samuel, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Daphne Matsiaraki, Mary Reese, Stephen Short, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to you, KALW is locally sourced, homegrown, independent, and commercial-free, listener-supported public radio. You're listening to music for the hammered dulcimer. That's an instrument that Robin Petry has been playing publicly since 1980. Petry is one of five members of Panacea, a group specializing in Baltic, Celtic, and medieval music. Panacea doesn't have any recordings, but the music you're hearing now gives you an idea of their sound. If it intrigues you, you can hear Petry and the other members of Panacea on Saturday at Wisteria Ways in Oakland. It's an 8 p.m. show. For more information on that or to hear more local music, you can visit our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can subscribe to the Cross Currents podcast. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.